It's 8 o'clock in South Central Wisconsin, and you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. And this just about does it for today's edition of Back Porch Serenade. This is Peter Haney saying we'll see you on the back porch next week. Keep it locked. The 8 o'clock buzz is coming up right after headlines from the BBC World Service.
Hello, I'm David Harper with the BBC News. The UN says women's bodies have become a battleground in Sudan, where 2 years into the conflict, rape is routinely being used as a weapon of war. The UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, said abuses were being committed by both the Sudanese army and the paramilitary RSF. There's growing concern about the hundreds of thousands displaced following the capture of the Zamzam refugee camp in Darfur by the RSF. Our Africa regional editor is Camilla Mills.
We're hearing harrowing stories of how they are arriving with gunshot wounds. Many of them have walked the 70 kilometres. It's taken them 2 days without any water, without any food. They're arriving dehydrated, dying, many of them also dead. We had a very harrowing statement from the UN today saying that women's bodies have become the battlegrounds in this conflict, with sexual violence and rape being systematically used as a weapon. They've said they've seen an increase of nearly 300% in requests for life-saving help after rape.
Several French prisons have been targeted in apparently coordinated attacks. Cars and mopeds were set on fire in prison parking lots in Paris, Valence and Aix-en-Provence. And the entrance gate of a prison in Toulon was hit by semi-automatic gunfire. The Justice Minister is visiting Toulon in a show of support for guards. Their union has demanded better protection for staff. Hugh Schofield reports from Paris.
In most cases, cars were set alight, but in Toulon, a prison wall was sprayed with Kalashnikov fire. The government says the attacks are the work of drugs gangs angered by the latest moves to crack down on their activities. A law is passing through the French Parliament now, which creates a special prosecutor's office to deal with drugs crime, with new powers for investigators. Two prisons are also being converted with extra security measures in order to house convicted leaders of drugs gangs and stop them communicating with their networks.
A Russian hairdresser has been sentenced to 5 years in jail for spreading false information about the war in Ukraine in a case brought after she was denounced by a neighbour. There's increasing concern wartime legislation is being used to settle scores, as our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg explains.
A few days after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, a number of repressive laws were adopted in Russia to silence criticism of the authorities and of the war. Russian hairdresser Anna Alexandrova had fallen out with her neighbour Irina over a plot of land in their village. It led to a feud and eventually to Irina reporting Anna to the authorities for spreading false information about the use of the Russian armed forces. Last year, Anna Alexandrova's defence lawyer told me that in Russia, the so-called political articles of the criminal code had become a convenient way to resolve conflicts between neighbours.
Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg with that report. This is David Harper with the latest world news from the BBC.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative, Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 Madison. Listener sponsored community radio.
The People's Station.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
No, I say you've been misled. You've been had. You've been took.
Man, listen, this is 2023, and we swinging chairs. I am not my ancestors, B.
Good morning, Madison.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The
drug of a nation. Ear hustlers, mount up. It's Tuesday, April 15th, 2025, and you're listening to the Tuesday 8 o'clock Buzz. This is Michael Friday before Spearhead, Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy with Television, the Drug of a Nation. Tara is out today, so we've got a special program on motherhood from the stoop on PRX called The Many Ways We Mother. It's a long one, so without that, on with the show.
Hey, Hannah. So you know how we do it on the stoop, sharing stories about the Black diaspora. And today, we're stooping about stories that redefine family.
Okay, Leela, tell me more.
She walks with a swagger. She's pretty pulled together. She wears her low-rise, cigarette-leg jeans when the trend is clearly high-rise, wide-legged. She does the electric slide at a party, but she can also work the middle. You know, till it hurts a little.
Ooh, work the middle till it hurts a little.
Okay, stay with me here.
Before I let go.
Stay with me, Hannah.
Okay.
She works hard. She plays hard. She's the life of the party and sometimes the last one to leave it. Or better, she's the one who leaves early because there isn't anyone there that she's trying to impress. She's celebrated in meetings because she says what she thinks. And some parents, they give her the side eye because their teenagers go to her for advice.
Okay, Leela, at this point, you really, really have to say who you're talking about. Who is this?
Hannah, this is the definition of an auntie. You know.
Oh.
You see a woman like this and you're like, look at that auntie over there.
But wait, I like her. Parts of her sound like us.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Hey, Auntie Leela. Hey.
Hannah, stop. Stop. Do not.
What? What?
Call me Auntie.
What?
A Black woman who has found comfort with the idea that she likes kids, but she probably doesn't want any of her own.
When I hear the word auntie, I think of love, happiness, and disciplinarian.
You know, she kind of got her life together. She's very comfortable with it. She got her money.
Unfortunately, our society, it tells women that having a child, there's a timetable to it. So I think the term auntie was invented specifically for women in kind of acknowledgement of this idea that because maybe you didn't have children within a certain type of window, it's not going to happen for you.
Rich is the stereotype of auntie, yeah. And they always give money to their nieces.
If you see me walking down the street, no, baby, I ain't your auntie, a wife.
You know, like, I don't think that's for other people to define. Like, I think it's perfectly fine for a woman, and obviously I'm not a woman, but a woman to be able to own that term and define it as she sees fit.
She wants to keep it sexy, and yeah, she just wants to have fun.
All right, so Leela, what is your issue with being called auntie?
I'm trying to work through what it is. Maybe you can help me out here.
Okay, sounds like you just don't like it. I'll try. But I gotta say, if I'm thinking about my own culture, kind of where I'm from, our community, calling someone auntie is like a status symbol, right? Like, it's like, it's respect. And it's even if someone isn't related to you. So like, my daughter's friends call me auntie, khaltu. We say khaltu. Mm-hmm. Khaltu Hana or khala Hana. I call my parents' friends auntie too.
Okay.
It's endearing.
In many cultures, it is, right? I get that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about it that's rubbing me the wrong way. Okay, I was in a Zoom meeting not long ago, and someone referred to me as Auntie Lily.
Oh, no. Okay, was this person a relative?
No, this was a business call. A business call for a project. And
No.
And they were a little bit younger than me. And it was someone I'd spoken with before, but never met in person.
Lily?
Yes. And as you can see, it got a little uncomfortable.
Okay, but it sounds like it got a little too comfortable. You know, I mean, there's a reason why we call people auntie, because they're close to us. And it's a symbol of respect.
Right, but there's another type of cultural trend of calling people auntie, right? It's not like the close to kin thing that you're talking about. It's more like people are calling celebrities that they respect auntie. It's a parasocial relationship thing.
A what now?
It's this idea that you think you know a famous person mm-hmm. or a well-known person because you see them all the time in media, but you don't know them personally.
Mm.
Kind of like a one-sided relationship.
Mm.
I think a lot of mm-hmm. people are calling famous Black women auntie because they're in the public eye. They're iconic. We don't know them personally, but they feel really familiar to us.
Right. Like who, though?
Okay, like Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Remember when she had her viral moment in a congressional meeting? She was asking Steve Mnuchin why he wasn't answering her questions about Trump's finances.
Mm-hmm.
And the former Secretary of the Treasury was giving her the runaround. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. He was trying to stall and he was trying to avoid her question and she was not having it.
Uh-huh. And then she said the greatest thing ever.
Reclaiming my time. What he failed to tell you was, when you're on my time, I can reclaim it.
In that moment, she became a political auntie.
You want to talk about the things I've done, but I'm reclaiming my time. Yeah. You want to speak on the battles I've won, but I'm reclaiming my time.
Ooh, well. It was iconic to see Maxine Waters, who's been in politics a long time, stand up, speak her truth, and demand respect.
Mm.
And she said what every Black woman was wanting to say in a meeting full of white faces who weren't listening.
Right. And after that, I remember when anyone was being disrespectful, folks would say, I am reclaiming my time. I am reclaiming my time. Yes.
I mean, she was leading by example, a very powerful presence. And she's one of the few Black women in Congress who has been in the game for a really long time. So seeing her up there, I think we all felt like we knew her, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Even if we don't know her.
Yeah, there was a lot of that at the time. And I'm wondering, did she mind that?
I'm so proud of this connection that I've made with these young people. They do call me Auntie Maxine. I embrace that. I love that. And I'm going to be their auntie. I'm going to keep telling the truth. And I want them to get out there, register people to vote, get active, and bombard, you know, the Congress of the United States and yep. the leadership with what they want them to do.
Turns out, she loves being called auntie. She feels it's a symbol of respect. She is a leader like aunties are. So, Lila, maybe when someone calls you auntie, it's a compliment.
I don't want to hear it. I mean, I know this title is for someone with experience and of a certain age. You know.
Ooh, a certain age.
I mean, okay. That feels like a big factor here. It's women of a certain age that are called auntie.
It's kind of like a rites of passage.
Well, I think auntie is more like old school.
There's also this notion that aunties are also like older, wiser people. And I think
a lot of our generation is very much still like, no, no, no. 30s a new 20, or like 40s a new 30, or like 50s a new 40. So I also think that like there's a subtle aging to the term auntie as well, too, that kind of offends some people.
Okay, there was this one moment I just want to share with you because it burns in my memory. Mm-hmm. It was from the 1990s, and it was this interview on a talk show, and Maya Angelou was being interviewed. And this 14-year-old girl in the audience asks her a question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Maya her views on interracial relationships.
Oh, thank you. And first, I'm Miss Angelou.
Miss Angelou.
Yes, ma'am. I'm not Maya. I'm 62 years old. I have lived so long and tried so hard that a young woman like you, or any other, you have no license to come up to me and call me by my first name.
Excuse me.
That's first. That's first. Also, because at the same time, I am your mother, I'm your auntie, I'm your teacher, I'm your professor. You see?
I mean, the humiliation. Every part of me started to shrink hearing that response from Miss Angelou, Dr. Angelou, Madame Angelou.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You know, I do think we grew up at a time where all elders had a handle before their name, right? It's doctor, it's Ms., it's Mrs., it's just what you did. Mm-hmm. You don't call an elder by their first name right away like that.
But there's also another side to that story of calling someone auntie. Mm. I mean, there's a complicated origin here.
Ooh, uh-oh.
So last year, author Dr. Imani Perry wrote an article for The Atlantic called What Black Women Hear When They're Called Auntie. And she says a lot of distinguished Black women are rejecting the term. Oprah Winfrey, Gayle King, actor Taraji P. Henson, singer Mary J. Blige. Dr. Perry writes that we can look at the origin of the word to understand why lots of women are rejecting it. Here's someone reading her article for us.
Though each woman has described her own reasons for rejecting the term, the common thread is the history of older Black women being referred to as auntie by white people during slavery and Jim Crow. It was, in that context, at once a sign of age and a mark of diminishment. Black women were deemed unworthy of being called Mrs. or Ma'am, or as we say in U.S. Black English, putting a handle on their names. In response to that insult in the Jim Crow South, it became common for Black people to refer to respected elders as Miss or Mister, followed by a first name, if the person was well known, and to maintain the formality of a last name designation in general.
I was reading a paper by historian Ronald L. F. Davis called Racial Etiquette, The Racial Customs and Rules of Racial Behavior in Jim Crow America. And it also talks about how during Jim Crow, white people were referring to Black women as auntie or girl, and how we were never respected enough as Black people to be called Mr. or Mrs. by white people. So you can see now why Miss Maya Angelou was demanding that respect.
Wow. I mean, now you can kind of understand the push to change, like the name on the Aunt Jemima syrup bottle when that was happening. Because mm-hmm. It sounds like there was some definite baggage with that word. Mm-hmm. I mean, Leela, I want to like calling people auntie. You know, I feel it's endearing. I had no problems with the word because, like I said, in my culture, it's a sign of respect, right? But it sounds like it really does not have the same origins as it does here in the U.S. This is problematic.
Uh-huh. I mean, words have different meanings across culture, and they also change through time. So I think people are rejecting the term because of its origin.
Mm-hmm.
But also, Dr. Imani Perry wrote about another reason, too. Calling people auntie can create a lot of assumptions.
The term is considered too familiar, assuming a connection that doesn't exist. And some have spoken out about an implicit ageism in the term and feeling that to be called an auntie means you must perform some kind of caretaking or advisory service for younger people. Auntie suggests older than me, and that can feel like a red flag.
This is what I'm saying. When people call me auntie in a business meeting and haven't met me before, they are assuming a connection that doesn't exist. And that they get to decide what I'm called? I mean...
Auntie is a word that comes with baggage, and young Black people calling Black women over 40 years old auntie in the public arena are not carrying that baggage. An auntie, in popular parlance, is defined by being independent, attractive, and powerful. Moreover, I think by using auntie, we are called to challenge the assumptions that go along with mother. Mothers, and Black mothers in particular, are so often expected to be long-suffering people in eternal service. So I am interested in what it means to name a social role for an older woman who is seen as liberated and not defined by caretaking. Reels on IG and posts on TikTok celebrate aunties. They are the women who come into the family gatherings unfettered and free to express themselves fully. The depiction, for me, feels freeing precisely because, according to cultural norms, Black women of a certain age are not expected to prioritize their own interests, desires, and well-being. Aunties don't play that. Aunties are fun. Aunties are playful. Aunties give advice with candor, something mothers often hesitate to do because they are preserving the illusion of parental respectability.
So I love everything about this type of auntie, but I think what's interesting is what she said about this Black auntie being freed from this expectation of caretaking. I don't know if that's true, because an auntie still takes care of people, right? She maybe not have her own children or take care of her own children, but there are nieces, there are nephews, there are her parents. And that's what Black life is like, right? You still have folks that you're taking care of. So I don't know.
Right. The Black auntie is always caretaking.
Right.
She's mentoring. She's leading.
Right.
She is, in essence, caring for the culture. And that's why so many people feel this bond with Black women of a certain age, I think.
I recently had my first nephew. Oh. I am an auntie for the first time ever. And it's a beautiful feeling. It's love. Like, it's not your child. But there's still such a closeness that you feel.
Yeah.
Like, I felt responsible for that child.
I know. I have nieces and nephews too, and I adore them. And I love being their aunt. I told you that I have a bunch of nieces and nephews. I love them babies. But Hana, they have never called me auntie.
What do they call you?
They call me by my name. And you know what? Now that I think about it, this bothers me.
Why does it bother you? Do you think it's disrespectful?
Doesn't it sound too casual, too familiar? I talked to two of my nieces about this. I asked them, why don't you call me aunt or auntie? This is Olivia. She's 20.
I don't call anyone aunt. Because, like, in my phone, your name is Aunt Leela. If someone asks, I'm like, that's my Aunt Leela.
But when you talk to me, you call me...
Leela.
How do I feel about that?
How do you feel about that?
I was thinking about the other day, is that you are my niece. I am your aunt.
Yeah.
But you call me Leela.
Okay, Leela. First of all, she sounds so cute. But what about other people in your family? How do they get addressed?
Exactly. I brought this up. What do you call your grandma?
Nana.
When you're talking to her, what do you call her?
Nana.
When you're talking about her, what do you call her?
Nana.
Am I considered an elder?
No.
Am I?
No. I think you're like 30. I think of you as like a teenage sister.
Sometimes aunts are just not seen as elders. That's what she's saying, that sometimes they have a different relationship with the children. And that is actually what Dr. Perry said, too, that aunts sometimes are seen as people that can be confided in. So what's the deal?
I mean, yeah, it's like I want the label and I don't want the label.
See, that's what do you want to be called Auntie Leela?
Maybe I just want the recognition of being an auntie without thinking about the aging part and the transition into that title. But my niece said something to me that I really hold on to.
You're too, like, hip and fun to be, like, Aunt Leela.
Okay. So I shouldn't look at it as not feeling like I'm respected as an elder. It's that, oh, I don't want to call you that because it feels too formal.
Yeah, way too formal. I'd take it as a compliment.
So, Hannah, let's keep talking about family. And let's hear a story about creating a family through IVF.
Right. For some people, especially Black women, having a baby doesn't come so easy. Black women have lower success rates with in vitro fertilization. And today, we'll hear one woman's journey to have a baby and a welcome surprise. And just a note, this story does touch on loss. So please take care of yourself while you're listening.
No matter where this journey takes us, I have learned that I am my own advocate and to never forget it.
This is Sharissa Jackson.
When I started to open up about this journey, I promised myself I would show the good, the bad, and the ugly.
She lives in Little Rock, Arkansas, and she's reading from some posts she's made online about her IVF journey. And she's got a list of questions that she's prepared for her next round of IVF.
Should we be doing genetic testing at this point? Should I have had a sonogram to look for scar tissue in the uterus before we started trying for baby number two? Is there anything stronger to suppress endometriosis?
So Sharissa and her husband, Dre, they got married in 2008. And they knew right away that they wanted to start a family.
We went probably for about 2 or 3 years just trying on our own. And in that time, you know, you're charting your ovulation. Everything is so like, okay, I'm ovulating. You know, everything is so in step, right? Like everything is so planned, I mean.
Did you have one of those charts on your phone? And
yes, I was buying the ovulation predictor kits and goodness, I can't even begin to tell you how much money I probably spent on ovulation kits and pregnancy tests.
After 3 miscarriages, her OBGYN sent her to a fertility clinic in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Honestly, I'm not sure what tests were done in order for them to like come to the realization that I have endometriosis. But that was one of the things that was described to us as like, this could be what is preventing you from getting pregnant.
So endometriosis, that is when the tissue lining of the uterus forms outside the uterus, and it can be really painful.
Yeah, so that was one of the many things they looked at when evaluating Sharissa. But there's a lot of other tests that happen when you go into an IVF clinic. You know, they test the sperm count to see if the sperm is viable. They look for blockage in your fallopian tubes. They measure your hormone levels in your blood. It's a lot.
And for Sharissa, they found endometriosis. So basically, the IVF doctors told her to go back to her OBGYN for surgery so she can have that tissue removed.
So had the surgery for endometriosis, and they may have made me wait a cycle or two before we were able to do IVF.
And you didn't have really painful periods, so you...
I did, but I didn't know that that was uncommon. Like, I didn't know that...
Yeah.
I thought that that was normal.
Yeah. Right. Because yeah. When you go and you to a doctor and you say, I have really painful period, mm-hmm. or really heavy bleeding, really bad cramps, they say, that's normal.
That's normal.
Being a woman.
That's normal. You know, it didn't know it wasn't normal, you know?
Yeah.
Leela, I have to say, this is all sounding really familiar. This idea of doctors just not acknowledging a woman's pain, not hearing her.
Right. And research shows that up to 50% of women who have fertility issues have endometriosis.
So she was focused on having a family. Mm-hmm. So Leela, I have this question. How is IVF supposed to work? What are the steps?
So a woman is given a hormone medication to stimulate the eggs, and then they monitor the growth of her follicles. Those are what hold the eggs. Then they give her what's called a trigger, and it's a shot that releases the egg from the follicles. Next, you go in for a procedure where they harvest the eggs. They use this little tool and they carefully suck them out. And then the next step is they take sperm, and in Charissa's case, it was her husband's sperm, and they fertilize the eggs. Next, you hope to have some embryos that are analyzed, and the doctors make sure they're ready for the final step, which is transferring the embryos into your uterus.
Okay, so Charissa is at the point where she's told to trigger to give herself this injection where the eggs will be released.
So my first round of IVF, they were able to retrieve 22 eggs.
That's a lot, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So Charissa decides that she wants to transfer two of the embryos with hopes of having twins.
All right, Charissa.
Yeah, I mean, why not? She had planned this all out.
We got the phone call. I was pregnant. So we go in and we find out both of these embryos are attached. So we're pregnant. We're pregnant with two.
Right.
Which was absolutely mind-blowing for me.
Charissa was excited about the twins. But 4 months into her pregnancy, when she went to her doctor for a checkup, the news wasn't good. She was told the twins wouldn't make it, and she would need to deliver them right away.
So I don't talk about this story a lot. I have shoved it so far.
Yeah.
I have shoved it so far in the depths of my memory that remembering the details now is kind of mind-boggling that I can, because I had to figure out how to forget it. And I delivered them and I asked not to see them. Like, I was just like, I cannot even look. Just take them away. So after that, I went home. You know, you're trying to recover grief, all that.
Leela, it's just so hard to hear. I don't know how Charissa is even able to share this story. So Leela, all of this was happening with Charissa. How was she processing this? How was she like dealing with all of this?
I asked her because I went through IVF too.
Do you remember like ever having a moment of resentment towards people that had babies?
I don't. I have never been in that space. I know a lot of women that have. I always just felt super sad for myself. I have had so many sorority sisters, friends that I have celebrated baby showers for. And for me, it was like, I'm just sad that I can't experience this. Never jealousy towards them or resentment towards them. I just have never felt like that.
Sometimes it was hard for me to look at people that had their babies, you know, pushing their strollers, yeah, you know, and like nursing or, you know, I just couldn't even look at it. It would anger me. Yeah, I would just be angry. Like, just to go to a cafe and see the ladies brunching with their babies, I would just be like, I gotta get out of here. I just can't even be around this.
I think it is perfectly normal. I'm probably the abnormal one, to be honest with you. But the thing that I found difficult were the questions. When are you gonna have a baby? You know, just all the questions that come with that. Those are that was the hardest part for me. So for me, when I went to baby showers or when I was planning baby showers, and I would prepare myself for the questions and what was I going to say today? today, am I going to say whenever God blesses us? Or am I going to be honest and say, well, I'm experiencing infertility. Is there anything you can help educate me on about that? Like how to get through that? You know, like since you want to be all in my uterus, let's talk about it. I literally hid this for years because I was scared about judgment. I was scared about what people would say.
Why, though? What gave you this feeling that people would judge you?
I just overall feel like infertility and IVF is so taboo. And when you grow up and you're a little girl, your grandparents, you see your grandparents have 10, 12 kids. Your parents have as many kids as they want to, as far as you're concerned. And nobody talks about the struggle. I was very ashamed of it. All my friends, all my sorority sisters around me that I, you know, knew of were just having babies when they wanted to have babies.
Hannah, this is a good time to talk about this idea, this myth about the hyperfertility of Black women. Because if you think about this shame that Charissa is talking about, it comes from a very specific place. So, Hannah, there's something we really need to address here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's this issue about IVF being taboo in our communities. I mean, there's a real reason that it's taboo.
Yes, the myth.
Yeah, it's this racist myth of the hyper-fertile Black woman.
Yeah, but that myth isn't true, especially today. There's been a decline in Black women having babies.
Right. And according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Black women are 2 times more likely than their white counterparts to be infertile. And we spoke with someone about this. Back in 2008, a fertility clinic called Shady Grove examined 40,000 IVF cycles of more than 22,000 white and Black patients. They took a look at this idea that Black women may have lower success rates when it came to IVF. So there are quite a few studies that show that both Black and white women produce around the same amount of eggs, but when it comes to the transfer of those embryos, so Black women were less likely to become pregnant. And I reached out to someone to talk about this, someone who might have some answers.
My name is Dr. Michael Thomas. I am a fertility specialist at the University of Cincinnati.
Dr. Thomas is the president of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. He's a reproductive endocrinologist.
Fancy way of saying fertility doctor.
I asked him about these studies. As Black women, are we really less likely to have success with IVF?
Is this true?
It's very true. There are a number of factors that sort of cause that phenomenon to take place. And it's been seen across the board in other studies as well, that Black women have lower success rates. A lot of it has to do with the fact that doctors in general, that they see their general OBGYNs, will tell them to go out and get pregnant more so and for longer periods of time than they would for their Caucasian counterparts. Therefore, Black women are sort of sent into this spiral where they're going to see the doc. The doctor keeps telling them to try, whereas their white patients go straight to the fertility specialist.
Lila, am I hearing this right? That Black women are not referred to the right people in time to help them with fertility?
Yes. And Dr. Thomas says he's seen this over and over again.
There's this thought that these doctors, both Black and white doctors, just think Black people can get pregnant. They don't need fertility help. All they need is time, because we see a lot of Black people out there and they're getting pregnant all the time. Therefore, you're going to get pregnant all the time. So there's this sort of weird mentality that these doctors, unfortunately, most of them are Caucasian, just think that Black people can just get pregnant. They don't need a lot of help. They just need to be out there trying. And then when they come back, by the time they come back, they are now older.
Dr. Thomas says that, combined with some of the conditions that are quite common for Black women, create this spiral.
Black women are more likely to have fibroids. Caucasian women, 20%, 25% at the most. African-American women, 50 to 80% may have fibroids. Fibroids may contribute to your ability or inability to get pregnant because you can have fibroids blocking the tubes. You can have fibroids that can cause a problem in the cavity of the uterus and therefore not allowing a baby to implant very well.
So he's saying issues like fibroids and endometriosis, those are things that can lead to this lower outcome.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, another study said that BMI, or body mass index, weight, also being the reason why Black women have more infertility. But here's the thing. Dr. Thomas says this.
Even if you take out the patients who have had fibroid issues, even if you take out the patients who had tubal issues, even if you take the same group of patients with the same BMI, those African-American women still have a lower success rate. And no one knows completely why.
So back to Sharissa's story. The last we heard, she had just been through this traumatic experience. She was given some time to heal by the doctors and then told she could try IVF again if she wanted to. And she did.
So I had one egg left. So what would you have done if you had one embryo left? Right? Like, you're not going to leave your baby.
And Sharissa does try again.
My daughter is a rainbow baby, so I celebrate her as that.
Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so having a rainbow baby is having a baby after having experienced a loss. A rainbow comes after the storm. So it is God's promise that He won't cause pain without there being something beautiful, which is the rainbow.
You have your rainbow baby.
I do.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Bluestem Jazz presenting the Jimmy Ferrace Quartet at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Jimmy Ferrace's recent debut album, Hours Fly, Flowers Die, is a heartfelt narrative with themes of nostalgia and the passage of time. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
Attention, WORT volunteers and donors. WORT is holding an election for 2 open participating member seats and 1 open listener sponsor seat to serve 3-year terms on the board of directors of Back Porch Radio Broadcasting, Inc., with terms beginning at the annual meeting in June and concluding at the annual meeting in June 2028. Financial acumen, computer literacy, and a willingness to work within a dynamic group to help shape this great station are all desirable qualifications. People of underrepresented groups are strongly encouraged to apply. Some committee hours are required outside of board meetings. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. on Thursday, May 15th to ensure consideration. Voting begins Thursday, May 29th and continues until the annual meeting on Sunday, June 29th. More information and board applications are available at wardfm.org or on paper in the station lobby. Help us keep WORT a vibrant and important part of our community. Apply today.
You're listening to a special program on motherhood on the Tuesday 8 o'clock buzz from The Stoop on PRX.
So many ways to form a family. It isn't always what we expect.
Yeah, that's why I love this next story about an unexpected family. So 2 women, Yasmin and Aaliyah, who were connected by raising a child. Yasmin and Eric were together, but Eric didn't want to be with Yasmin. And then Aaliyah enters the picture, and Eric wanted to be with her. I know, it's complicated.
She lives in New Jersey. She's Haitian. She's proud. And like many of us, she had this picture in her mind about what her family should look like. And in that picture was her, the father of her child, and her daughter, Sky.
I'm not a jealous person. I'm just not. I may look to see who you're looking at, to see what you like or whatever, or try to be like that person that you're probably more infatuated with, but jealous? No. I would say when I was with Eric, I was addicted to him. Eric is the first person I fell in love with. Eric's the person that I love. When I became pregnant, I was 22. I expected to be with Eric. I expected to live with Eric, and this is my baby, this is the father, and this is what family's supposed to look like. But he told me that he was never going to marry me. The day that I saw the eviction notice on his door, I was like, oh, where is he living? I found out he's living with Aaliyah. From there, I just knew they're going to play house with my baby.
A veterinarian, a cartoonist slash star, and when I grow up, I'm
and this is when things can take a turn, right? That moment when families need to blend just to keep the peace.
Yeah, and that blending now involves Yasmin becoming a single parent and then having to bite her tongue around the new girlfriend, Aaliyah. But while Yasmin was giving major side eye, Aaliyah was actually looking forward to being part of this co-parenting scenario.
Eric finally said, you need to meet her.
So as Aaliyah approached Yasmin's door, she was totally nervous. It was this balancing act, you know, to make herself heard, but to try not to be too loud, be kind of cordial, but also be assertive. And all she felt was tension.
I was like, so, hey, Yasmin, I'm Aaliyah. I know that there have been some issues surrounding me being around your daughter. I fell in love with Sky the moment I met her. She was just feisty, fun, and funny.
Comedian?
Anything else? We had this thing called book day. So embarrassing now. Eric and I would wake her up saying, it's book day, it's book day. It's like, I like polka dots and stripes.
You really like polka dots and stripes?
That's my thing. That's my jam. Polka dots and stripes. I love book day.
We did a family newsletter one summer.
Let's buy a book. It's an interesting thing to be an adult and have this little one who gets you and that you get them. And that can be intoxicating. Eric moved in with me. Pretty much immediately after that, I felt like I was being thrust into some sort of pseudo-motherhood. 90% of pseudo-motherhood with Sky was hair-related. She had hair on top of hair on top of hair. Usually, I would do what was called a remix, like a music remix. The dent is still there. Don't comb it out. You smooth it with some cream. You put the ponytail right back, and then you twist it or do whatever. I never started from scratch, but I was always really self-conscious about sending her home presentable. You know, that's the sign of someone who just ain't got it together. When you send a kid back with the hair a mess, mm-mm. So I tried my best, but nothing was okay. If I did something wrong, I was wrong. If I did something right, I was also wrong.
Oof, and that's hard. That's something that step-parents are just always worried about. Will I make the mom mad? Am I doing things right? They're just constantly comparing.
Mm-hmm. And that can be frustrating, too.
I would put Sky to bed. She would say, you know, my mom really doesn't like you.
The children have no filter. So Aaliyah and Yasmin were really not feeling each other. And caught in the middle is little Sky. And the tensions were high.
Mm-hmm. And Yasmin's Haitian, remember? And Aaliyah is African-American. And the cultural differences at one point really started to get to them. Yasmin has some things to say.
I didn't have to say, hey, I'm not Aaliyah's friend. She can sense it. She can see it. She can feel it. Like the rice situation, I like the bottom part of the rice called gratin and Creole. Sky loved it when she was home with me until
one day she comes home and said, well, Aaliyah says, I don't have to eat that. That's the burnt part. That's the bad part. I'm like, what is this woman saying to my child? This is my culture, and this is something that my child liked before, but because Aaliyah said no and Aaliyah doesn't like it, now she doesn't.
And then there were the differences in discipline. Aaliyah had issues with Yasmin's parenting style, a lot of issues.
I was very critical of Yasmin as a parent. Haitian culture in general, they expect absolute, abject obedience from their offspring. And there's no talking back. There's no bartering. There's no nothing. There's a lot of corporal punishment, which I did not agree with. I was really judgmental.
But for Yasmin, the Haitian way of parenting was all she knew.
A lot of people say you run your house like you're in the military, you're a soldier or something, or you're a general. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm Caribbean. Kids are supposed to do as I say, look pretty, and behave. Every time she came back from Eric's and Aaliyah's home, it took 2 days to reprogram her. Whatever you're doing at daddy's house, that's not the way it happens here. She came home with Aaliyah's socks. I was like, why are you wearing somebody else's socks? Maybe part of me thought I was hurting Aaliyah because I lost it that day. It didn't matter that Sky was my daughter at that point. It didn't matter. I just lost it. That's all I'm gonna say. I wasn't the best mom that day. And I'm sorry for it. I am this very tough, tough individual. And I know this sounds all weird or confusing to you, but I wanted my kids to be tough. So at times I was tough with them.
It was Sunday, and it was after a holiday weekend. And this was a weekend that little Sky had spent with Eric and Aaliyah at the beach.
And Sunday night, I'm looking at Sky's hair, and I'm like, this is bad. This is really bad. There's sand in her hair, and there's water, and it's all this nonsense. And it was already a hairstyle in place before you got in the water. So that's a whole different level of tangled. And I was thinking, I don't have to do anything to her hair. You should have had her hair in braids when we picked her up, and then it would have been okay right now. I'm leaving, so you can deal with that. But I just thought about, like, how she was going to school the next day. When I was in third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Ambrose, we were taking a test, and it was really quiet. And Mrs. Ambrose said, Aaliyah, come here. And she waved me up to her, and she opened this drawer next to her, and she took out this box. And she made me stand there, and she did my hair for like 40 minutes. She took down all my messy braids that my mom had done a month before. She took each one of them out. She sprayed grease on it. She combed it through. She put little pins and beads. And I mean, like, I was ready for, like, Christmas Day pageant. And I was really embarrassed, so she made me stand up there. But she was just disgusted. Hair speaks for your family. Hair speaks for your mom. Hair speaks for your neighbors, your aunties. Like, Sky's hair represented an entire generation of people. So for a lot of different reasons, I finally just said, you know what, I'm going to do her hair. Like, do her hair for real, not a remix. And I remember Eric saying, don't do it. Do not do it. I parted her hair across the center.
Sky, it's kind of tingly right here.
And with this front part, I made about 15 small cornrows.
Okay, are you ready? Because this part right here really hurts.
Going back, like a tiara.
Baby, I'm so sorry.
And then with the back, you raise those up and up and up and up. You have to go really slow.
Okay? I'm so sorry, baby. I'm so sorry.
The process took about 7 hours for me. I'm like 3 or 4 hours behind the regular, authentic Black mom.
Mm-hmm.
So we dropped Sky back off to Yasmin. The first thing I did was check my email. There was an email from Yasmin, and I didn't even look at it right away. I was like, oh my God, what now? Let me guess, all of her hair fell out. Or you have a migraine now, you're gonna miss work for a week because I used the wrong grease. What is it? And I opened it up and it said, Aaliyah. And I stopped right there because she just addressed me by my actual name. I definitely hadn't heard her say my name ever in 5 years. She would just find a very crafty way to use a pronoun. The email said something like, hey, Aaliyah, thank you so much for Sky's hair. I know this was a lot to do, and I really appreciate it because I didn't know what I was going to do. She has school tomorrow, and it just looks really, really great. Thank you, Yasmin. And I was like, oh, my God. I unclicked it so that I could click it again because I wanted to make sure, like, that it was really what I thought it was. That was it. We never turned back.
Don't remember her. You do.
What? It was so cute. And you thanked me. You don't remember emailing me?
I don't remember that.
Like, I don't even really think about the Sky connection as much. She's 22.
I'm Sky. I am about to graduate the Rhode Island School of Design in like a week. It's crazy.
It's hard for me to even remember what happened when she was 3 and 4 and 5. We don't navigate around Sky anymore. We navigate around Maisie. I saw her hair, Leah. So what's up? You need some help?
When they both had kids, there was like some bridging that happened or something between both households.
I think it was like co-parenting because...
Yeah, it was like co-parenting.
You and that damn slingshot and my baby.
It wasn't a slingshot. You know, I used to wear him.
And seeing the relationship they have after my dad, outside of my dad. Especially now that Aaliyah's divorced and I don't know much, but I do know that like that my mom has sort of like helped support her through that.
It's not a friendship. We're not friends. Friends are not picking up your kids and their own twice a week for over a year. Because once you start doing that with someone, that's a thing, like with a capital T. And
Yasmin would just be like, get my baby out of that thing.
Their relationship has made me think about competition between women as a product of like a male gaze and like there not being room for more than one woman in my life.
Right.
If Eric was to be with someone else, it really depends who it is.
I'm not looking forward to navigating those waters.
You're a different relationship, yeah.
You should get back with him. That would be perfect.
You just made imagine. A side
turn. Then I don't have to worry about it because I know who the person is. I love them around my kids. We can automatically get to that space. That would be like the perfect. No.
Never.
You could grab my soda in my room for me. It's on my dresser. And like, whoa, these two people really finally actually are family for one another.
I do have a key. I have the key. I forgot I can lock myself out. I mean, call me later. All right, bye. I love you.
Bye. I love you too. Bye.
She was about to say bye, Mom. So there you go. Bye.
And that's The Stoop. The Stoop is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts.
The Stoop family includes producers Natalie Peart and Megan Tan, editor Christina Loring, art by Nima Iyer, social media by Summer Williams, sound design and engineering by James Rollins at Roof Dog Studio.
Special thanks to the NPR Story Lab. Subscribe to The Stoop podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've been listening to this special program on motherhood from The Stoop on PRX, The Many Ways We Mother, on Tuesday 8 o'clock buzz on WRT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm John Miner, engineer. Coming up after this, 3 hours of folk music on Green Morning Radio with Brian Hirsch, right after The Insurgent Radio Kiosk. Make it a good week, people. Peace.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Tuesday, April 15th.
How ironic. The most inefficient bureaucracy in government turns out to be Trump's Department of Government Efficiency. That could be humorous, except that DOGE, a creature of the right-wing Project 2025, has been devastating to millions of people, and it's about to get worse. Elon Musk, the flighty uber-rich autocrat put in charge of efficiency by his buddy Trump, is now going after the Social Security deposits of 73 million senior citizens. But wait, hasn't Trump himself promised loudly and often that he would not axe this essential retirement program? Yes, but Elon is his gotcha. Rather than an honest kill, Musk is strangling the program with, believe it or not, bureaucratic red tape. Claiming to be cutting waste, he's eliminating 7,000 people who administer the program, shouting, "Bureaucratic excess!" Except, Social Security is actually a renowned model of government efficiency, spending less than 1% of its revenue on administration. So by whacking the people who do the work, Musk is actually whacking the people who are due to receive their earned benefits. For example, he's decreed that the public can no longer apply for benefits or resolve questions by phone, but now must travel in person to some distant Social Security office. But the staff there has also been decimated, so people who've come from afar are told to go back home.